So, tell me about the fringes of Imagineering. I'm really curious.
The fringes? Well, that was your phrase. So, I use it in the way I've always used it.
Yeah, but you have unusual things that happen, right?
I have, well, there's things that happen. You know, Imagineering can go many different ways, and it's really because we're all completely individuals, and so everybody uses it, experiences it, through their individuality, and that's the wonderful thing about the technique. So some people will take the little light and take it inside their body, and I always say to people, the little light knows where to go. And just take your imagination with it. What I'm trying to do is to stop them thinking. I remember the words of my first teacher, Wilf Proudfoot, who said, lose your mind and come to your senses.
Okay.
So I want, what I'm aiming for is that it's the imagination and the tapping that are doing the work. It's not the person's thinking mind, which is thinking, well, this is what I should see, or this is how what I should do to what I should see.
Right.
Yeah? That it's happening spontaneously through imagination, and the tapping is doing the work. If people start using the thinking mind, well, they might as well just go and do, you know, guided visualization work, which is very, you know, which is very effective, but not as effective as adding in the tapping. And when we add in the tapping, we need to trust the tapping and let the tapping do the work. And once that penny drops, because people want to do something, and particularly people who come from a background in hypnotherapy where you're using suggestion, or NLP where you're using language of influence and indirect suggestion, they want to be, you know, the one who's doing it. But it seems to work for me with this process much better when you just let go of doing, and when you let the imagination really be the translator, and let the tapping be the, let the tapping do the work, let the tapping be the unsticker, the WD-40. And then when you get the thinking mind out of the way, that's when it can be really surprising.
Yeah, and, okay. Now, one of the things you mentioned with the little light in, and I guess I'm going to change the subject slightly here, but the question is bugging me. I've tried it a couple of times with people, and when I say this is a test, they go right to what they think the issue is.
I think that's to do with how you're setting it up and what you're saying to them.
Okay.
I always say, first, we're just going to do a test drive first. So I ask them where the symptom is. And I only use this technique, Imagineering, for physical symptoms.
Okay.
It's not for emotional or felt stuff in the body. It's for actually something concrete, you know, like a joint or a muscle or an organ or a tendon or a nerve. It's something which is physically present.
Or diabetes, or?
Well, then, yes, with diabetes, then we have to go to the organ. We have to go to the place. It's about the places in the body, the physical body. Because I think if we were to use this with an emotion, which is felt in the body, it's almost like we're using imagination to go inside an abstraction, and it becomes too removed, sort of like a squared degree away from reality. And I think that could be, if someone had a tendency to psychosis, I think it's an invitation to that, to use this for emotional stuff. And I know people have, and they've had very intense reactions, which is okay if you have the expertise and experience to handle it, but many people don't. So this is the physical stuff. And in setting it up, it's really important to ask, where is the symptom? I ask the person, you know, where, I don't need to know the diagnosis, I don't need to know the label, what it's called. I need to know, where in your body is it? So say somebody shows me that, you know, they put their hand on their left side. That tells me where it is. So we do the test run somewhere where it isn't. And I usually do the test run within the head, the skull, because unless the problem was, you know, someone had neuralgia, which was very, or something very close to that area, in which case I'd do the test run somewhere else, say in their knee. The test run is there to find out for both of us, for us, for me and for them, what kind of, how their imagination works, because everybody has an imagination. Some people say, oh, I don't have an imagination. Well, they do. And if they say that, I say to them, well, do you ever get anxious? Oh, yes, they get anxious. Well, you can't get anxious without an imagination. To get anxious, you have to go into the future and imagine bad stuff happening. You have to take yourself out of the present moment, and that requires an imagination. Some people have very detailed, technicolor, full surround sound, amazing imaginations. Other people just have kind of almost just sort of shades of light and dark and all sort of vague presences of something. And that's fine. That's fine. And we do the test run so that we know, we both know what we're working with.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yep.
So the way I set it up is to say, we're just going to do a test run now. And we're going to do a test run where the symptom isn't. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And I kind of built in the test run because I found that it gave, it took the pressure off. And it gave everybody an experience. Because in the test run, if someone just goes in and says, with the little light, and says, oh, there's just blank, I just say, what sort of a blank is that blank? And there's often some detail in the blank. And that's fine. And it gives you, as the practitioner, an opportunity to praise whatever they come up with. So that, because people will have this, oh, I'm not going to do it right, or I don't have an imagination, or it won't work for me. And the test run just seems to get around that. Yeah?
Yeah, okay. That's cool.
Yeah. And then we take the little light. And I usually give people a little introduction about what we're doing. And I think a lot of this is in the e-book that I have, which people can download from my website, which has the steps of Imagineering in it and lots of ways to use it. I'll start by just giving a little explanation. And I like to give a little story about how I was backpacking with my friend Nancy, and we were in Colorado, and we were going up this very, very steep, long trail with very heavy packs, and it was very hot.
Yep.
And Nancy's knee was hurting, and she was really complaining about her knee. And I just said rather glibly, I said, I wonder what your knee is trying to tell you. And she just snapped back at me, I don't speak knee. And that was the aha moment for me. I just stood there and laughed because I got it that because we know that, you know, our bodies have a language, and many people have intuited into what the body is trying to say through different symptoms, as the wonderful work by Louise Hay and by others. Our bodies are trying to say something with every symptom. And when we try and mask the symptom, they just shout louder. They're trying to get a message across. But we don't speak. Our minds, our thinking verbal minds, don't speak knee or hip or pancreas or whatever. And we're not getting the message. So the body shouts louder. The thinking mind takes more drugs or ways to suppress it. And so the body finds another way to shout. And you have these two mutually unintelligible parties escalating against each other. And what imagination is like the translator. And I also tell people about how a time with my family, my parents, when I was a teenager, we were in France, and the car broke down. And we find a garage and a mechanic, but the mechanic doesn't speak English, and my father doesn't speak French. So my father tells the problem again, louder. So the mechanic responds louder. And no, this is getting nowhere until my mother, who does speak French, walks into the garage and translates. Now, she doesn't understand what's wrong with the car. She doesn't understand the mechanic's knowledge of how to fix it. But once she starts to translate, my father and the mechanic start to solve the problem. So this is what the imagination is doing. And you don't interrogate the translator. You simply use the translator to be a go-between. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So this is what the imagery is doing. So it doesn't matter what the imagery is. And we don't go and say, oh, what does that mean? You know, Jungians, it's absolute torture doing this for Jungians because they just want to get into the interpretation and meaning of all this imagery. Whereas when you're working with this method as a practitioner, all you do is give the imagery back to the person with the tapping. Now, the imagery may be all sorts of stuff. Some people will go into a symptom and they will see something very literal, almost like they've gone inside an anatomy textbook. They will be, you know, seeing the bones and the muscles, and they'll be seeing the infection or the inflammation or whatever it is. And it's very real and literal. Other people will get something entirely metaphorical. I remember one woman, it was like a ball of feathers, a big ball of feathers. And so that's what she saw. And all you do as the practitioner is give back their exact words with EFT. Once you've kind of got some of the imagery, you just give it back. Not adding anything, not changing anything, not reframing anything, not trying to fix anything, simply neutrally giving it back. So if someone says, it's a big ball of fluffy white feathers and I can't see a way in, then we just go, even though it's a big ball of fluffy white feathers and I can't see a way in, I'm okay, or I accept myself, or whatever you want to say. I tend not to use I love and accept myself unless I know the person does love and accept themselves. And many of the people that we're seeing with serious problems do not love themselves. So if you ask them to say that, you're going to muddy the waters by bringing in a lot of resistance to that. So I don't. I just use I'm okay, I accept myself, or something simple.
Yeah?
So we just give back whatever the imagery was, and we do a round of tapping on that. And then have them go back to that place with the little light. And what's it like now? Or what's, I don't say what you see because they may be other senses. I just say, what's there now? And, oh, the outer feathers are unfolding and some of them are floating away and there's something red in the middle. Okay, give that back. Even though the outer feathers are unfolding and floating away and there's something red in the middle, I'm okay. You get the idea?
Sure.
Yeah. So we just...
I've listened to the recordings before, so this is mostly repeat for me. I was thinking maybe you had some unusual things that happened or, like people do the tapping and then somebody comes along and does surrogate tapping and like, oh my goodness, what's that, you know?
Someone did do surrogate imagineering work once. And she had an amazing result with it. Her sister had breathing problems, something about her lungs. I don't remember exactly what the condition was. And her sister wouldn't have anything to do with EFT or anything alternative. But it was getting really bad, so her sister could hardly breathe. And this girl did, she used a little light to imagine going inside her sister's lungs and just tapping for what she found there.
Uh-huh.
And that night she saw her sister, who was just breathing much more easily and much more relaxed, and said something like, oh, well, you know, obviously the medication's working now. And she didn't say anything. She didn't. Yeah. But yes, we can, it seems that we can use it surrogately as well.
Okay. Yeah. Anything else unusual like that?
Well, do you know, George, I can't actually remember, because when I'm working with someone, I'm in an altered state. And so afterwards, unless I write it down, I've forgotten.
Okay. Well, that's no fun for finding out the magic that's hidden there.
Well, the magic just emerges. And sometimes afterwards, a person will interpret the imagery. You know, there's often something really quite spiritual, that the imagery will start by there's something wrong or dark or broken or inaccessible or shut away or trapped. There's something, you know, not right. And we keep giving back the imagery and tapping, giving it back and tapping, giving it back. And then often there's something very beautiful, profound, or spiritual starts to happen. There may, and several times, there's been some sort of little creature, a frog or a lizard or a rabbit or some little creature that appears in the imagery. Or there can be, I can't remember. Something which was threatening becomes something really pleasant, like something that was like a dark, threatening pool of water becomes like clear, blue, warm, and I like to have the person just sit in that feeling for a while. Just sitting in the feeling so that they can capture and remember and get back to that feeling, because it's their feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, something really horrible turned into something beautiful.
Yeah, and afterwards, you know, I had one woman who, 6 months later, I was speaking to her, and her horrible thing had been about being, like water that would suck her down, a pool that she would drown in, and being out of her depth, and the fear, and it transformed into, you know, lovely warm blue. And then afterwards, she 6 months later, she realized that she got this symptom whenever she was out of her depth at work. She was asked to take on something new and she felt out of her depth. So there was a metaphor in all the imagery, but the symptom changed without her at the time having to understand that imagery. And then months later, she got the understanding. So that's like Milton Erickson said. He said insight follows change, whereas the traditional psychotherapy was change follows insight.
Right. Yeah, I think I've seen it many times myself, that the insight follows the change.
Mm-hmm. And the the imagination and the tapping together have this, I call it the emotional WD-40 effect, that just loosens something. And when that something loosens and that something can move, it's like afterwards the thinking mind can catch up and dot all its I's and cross all its T's and
Well, you know, did you see the experiments done with people with extreme epilepsy, grand mal seizures, and they split the corpus callosum? So there was literally two brains functioning in the person's head instead of one?
No.
Oh, that was so amazing, because the left brain had explanations for absolutely everything and usually made no sense.
Mm-hmm.
The one experiment I remember seeing very vividly, they took and they flashed a picture of a nude to the emotional side and a picture of an old man to the verbal side. And the person got embarrassed, and then they were asked, why are you embarrassed? And the verbal side had an answer. It's that funny machine. Didn't make any sense at all. It had an explanation.
The thinking mind seeks is a meaning making organ. It seeks to find explanation, and it will. So when something happens, as you say, that is an emotional feeling, the thinking mind is always trying to make sense of it, make an explanation of it, and it can be completely wrong.
Yeah, even nonsensical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another quote of Milton Erickson, he said, the only function of the thinking mind in therapy is to write the check.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do that one.
Yeah. So what else can I tell you?
Well, I was hoping that you had a whole truckload of unusual things that came up.
Well, you know, these things happen, and they when I'm in it, when I'm doing this with someone, I'm really fully in it. And then afterwards I kind of move away, and I suppose, it's done. Yeah, you know, that it did its work. I don't, you know, sorry. I probably should have a truckload of stories. And, I'm so used to this doing what it's supposed to do that, it doesn't surprise me anymore.
It's a super tool. You don't need to be concerned about it anymore. That's cool.
Yeah, and the stuff, sort of weird or wonderful imagery and stuff. That's what happens. So it's not a surprise. So, yeah. Sometimes the imagery can be very dark. And it can take some time, but, as long as this tiny little change is happening, I just keep going, and we just keep going, and sometimes those tiny little changes can be very tiny and very little and very slow, and then it all just starts to flow and starts to move, and there's a big change. And, it is about letting the tapping do the work. Some people want to almost let the light do the work that they're using. They're almost like doing like a spiritual healing, and the light is they're shining the light so that the light heals. That to me is more like doing a guided imagery, which is effective. But the results I've had with just standing back, letting the tapping change the imagery, and letting the tapping do the work, then it goes to places that are surprising. And it's the surprisingness, the unexpected memories that can come up, the unexpected things that happen with the imagery. That's when I go, okay, this is really cooking now.
Yeah, okay. So in other words, somebody may come up with a trauma that they had as a 3-year-old.
Yeah, 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 or even something earlier than that. They might suddenly in the imagery be seeing a baby and realize the baby is them.
Ah.
Yeah, or they might be seeing someone else. And sometimes the imagery is just pure abstract imagery, like the sort of ball of feathers and the red thing and so on, and it just keeps changing. And we just keep going until it changes into something which has a feeling of pleasantness or peace or rest about it. Other times, all sorts of characters, people, memories can come into the imagery, in which case we just go off and work with those as we would with classic EFT, and then come back with the little light to the symptom and what's there now. The little light and the symptom is in a way the way we test and measure as things are changing. What's happening to the imagery is the measure of the change.
Yeah. Now, have you had times where you had somebody go into where the problem was, shine the light in, and they came up with some imagery, some imagination, you tapped on it, and they go, oh my goodness, I know it's gone. Or you look at there and it's all something pleasant, almost immediately.
It can happen, yeah. And if that does happen, then I want them to have a real good, I have them go back with the light and I have them have a real good check around. Just have a real good thorough check around. That's gone. And just really check around. Is there any little bit of it left? Make sure we've done a really thorough job. Because sometimes people almost just, they want so much for it to be gone that it's kind of gone because of how much they're wanting it to be gone. And if we do a really thorough check around, we might find a tiny little bit. And then, okay, we need, it's that tiny little bit that we really need to work on. Or I say, have a real good check around. And is there anything that could bring that back or allow it to come back? Yeah, because that's then what we need to work on. So if it all sort of just changes in a flash and is completely gone, I want to be a bit more thorough.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like Gary says, test, 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 and test.
Absolutely, and that's what makes EFT, you know, it's one of the things that really makes EFT different. That we can and we do test, and testing is what shows you where to go next.
Yeah.
Oh, well, then, you know, if someone goes in and say, oh, it's completely gone, then I sort of come back to the here and now and the physical symptom and say, well, what does it feel like? You know, what's the pain like? What's the movement like? Yeah. What can you do now that you couldn't do before? And then I want them to go and see their doctor. I want them to go and kind of get it checked out, tested medically.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, it's about doing the Imagineering over and over again. Then that something will change and then something else. And then it's like you clear one thing and then the body presents the next. Like goes, okay, great. This is great. You've done that one. Here, have a go at this one.
Do you ever get into something that you switch from Imagineering to, you know, it's like an emotion? You connect with a deep emotion, like, oh, go ahead.
Well, if there's a deep emotion, I just incorporate that in the Imagineering. And I'm always going with the imagery. So say, you know, I was just making up an example of the ball of feathers and the red thing, and so it's the person goes in and it's like there's this red thing and there's just sheer frozen terror. Then I just incorporate that, even though there's a red thing in the ball of feathers and sheer frozen terror. Yeah, so I'm still always going with the imagery and never focus just on the emotion, because the emotion is connected to the imagery.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you just keep doing the Imagineering, even though you've got a real strong issue there.
Well, what do you mean by it, a real strong issue? If it's an emotion, it's part of the experience of the imagery. If a memory comes up, I would go and deal with that memory, you know, using movie technique, tell the story, work through the details of the memory, and then I would come back to going inside with the little light and see what's changed as a result of doing that.
Yeah, okay.
Or if there is a person appears in the imagery, I might have a kind of like an EFT dialogue with the person. And then go back to the imagery, because the imagery is the test.
Okay. Interesting. I'm not quite getting what you mean by a person when you do an EFT dialogue.
Well, there was one woman I remember, she had a lump on her breast, and she was waiting for the results of the biopsy, and we did Imagineering, and she went inside the lump, and there's various rounds of tapping, but at some point inside the lump, she saw her son, and she had a son with learning difficulties, mental health problems, and he was inside there. And so we just started to tap and talk to him. She had an imaginary conversation with him whilst tapping.
Ah.
Yeah? And then when she went back into the lump, she saw that he was packing a suitcase. And then we did some more tapping just on that imagery. And then when she went back in, she saw he was walking away with the suitcase.
Yeah.
Yeah?
So the real core of the lump was leaving, has left.
Yeah. There was also within the lump, there was a whole, he left. And then there was, I think, something like a pile of photographs of times when things had been really difficult for her and very stressful. And so we just tapped through for the pictures of, on each of those photographs and the emotions about the photographs until the lump was all kind of cleaned out and it was cozy in there and she felt that she could almost sit in there and meditate.
Yeah.
And then when she went, she had the biopsy and she had got the results and it was benign.
Yeah.
Now, whether it was all the time benign or whether the tapping changed anything, I don't know.
Yep.
Don't know, can't say. But
that's like with one of your students a few weeks back. We did tapping for a very close friend of hers and turned out when the test results came back, it was not cancer at all.
Good, good. And we never know, you know, we're not at the stage of sort of clinical proof, but we just keep doing it anyway because whatever. Well,
much of the time it does work that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've done surrogate tapping with enough people or, you know, with four other people, that I know it works. There's zero doubt in my mind that sort of thing can work.
Oh, yeah. The surrogate tapping work I've done, that can be so amazing and surprising. Particularly, I find, for animals, because they're not going to make up the change. They're not going to pretend. And when an animal changes, it changes instantly. Its behavior changes, and there's no other explanation.
Well, you might have one other explanation here or there, but not with a string, not with a series of them.
Yeah, yeah. And we've done so many now. I've been doing this surrogate tapping for animals for about 6 years now, and it surprises me more when there's no change. And actually, when there's no change, that's when I really learn something, because I go back to, you know, what I can remember of how we did the tapping. And often there's no change when a person was leading, when they were suggesting, when they were trying to tell the animal what to do, and the animal just doesn't.
Okay.
Or there's no change if we don't get to the sensitizing experiences, even if they're made up, because often the person doesn't know the animal's history.
Okay. But
when we get to some sort of earlier experience, then there's nearly always change. The other time there isn't change is when the person doesn't allow the kind of surprising intuitive things to come in. They dismiss them and reject them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Any more?
Well, not that I can think of. Have you done anything other than strange other than imagineering and surrogate tapping?
Oh, I'm doing some group intergenerational work, family reconstruction, having a group play a person's ancestral family, parents, grandparents, and we tap through as very strong emotions and issues emerge, and we tap through those to very profound change. So that's the new thing I'm working on, is the group surrogate tapping for dead people.
Okay.
And that's quite amazing. That's very profound. Yeah.
Yeah, I found something similar, but I find it very profound too.
Yeah. I think there's two sorts of research. There's the sort of research that fills in the gaps and proves things, seeks to prove things to other people. And then there's the research which expands the boundary, which finds the new stuff and the expansive research. And that's where I love going with EFT is, what can we do with this now? And uh-huh. And as we're kind of doing that, we're starting to understand more about what's really going on here.
Yep.
And what I'm starting to learn about surrogate tapping is that it's not doing to someone. It's not a treatment. It's not a, I will change you or whatever. It's a means of communication. It's a means of communication at a deep unconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so it's almost like, counselling is talk at a conscious level. This is like a deep unconscious counselling.
Yep.
And it's allowing a person to feel heard and connected, and that is often sufficient for them to let go of a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you, you're talking about trying new things and finding out what works and what doesn't work. One of the things that I've been wanting to share with a lot of people is a really neat way to take and introduce people to tapping.
Uh-huh.
I took a look long ago and I said, what is it that makes for lots of tapping versus not so much tapping?
Yeah.
And I said, all right, well, there's multiple aspects. That makes it more tapping generally. If it came from multiple instances, like, my father did this every time such and such happened, then that made it more difficult. And so as an experiment, I asked somebody, okay, I want you to come up with a painful memory that came from a single instance that wasn't overly traumatic, and it was simple. And so anyway, I tapped with them on the issue and it was gone in one round.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I did it again and I did it again and I did it again. And I got up to where I was over 80%, one or two rounds of tapping for a significant issue, like at least 6 in intensity.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really cool way to introduce people to tapping.
Well, it is. If they can find that, because for people who are distressed or sort of highly anxious, depressed, whatever, you ask them to find what you're asking for is like a single stick off the pile of pickup sticks. They won't be able to find it, and they will go to something complex and muddy, or they will go to their major life trauma, which is too much.
Right.
So
I tell them, no, I don't want to do that.
You don't want to do that.
Right.
With your sort of what I'd call your normal ambulatory neurotics, if people can find that single incident, then yes, you'll really get a big change doing that. But there's a load of people who won't be able to find that. And in merely trying to find that, they will open up the can of worms.
Ah.
So you've got to be careful. So you have to have this sort of intuition of whether the question you're asking, can this person answer this question? And if you get a yes, go ahead and you'll get those, those.
Yeah, I'm not trying to work on somebody who's come to me because they're in big pain. I'm just saying, I have this friend and he comes by and he talks to me and I say, hey, I'm doing this really thing called EFT. He tells me about, he doesn't have anything. And I said, well, what about when your dog didn't come back? We think the coyotes got it. And he goes, oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a good example. So that's a good way. But if at any time, with a friend, because there are many people out there sort of putting on a good face, getting through their lives and stuff, and they've got a whole mass of stuff shoved under a tight-fitting lid. So if at any time you're sort of introducing this way of working and asking them for that single memory, if you get an intuition, there's a can of worms here, just back off. And then you still want to introduce EFT to them. Do the same thing that you're doing, but do it with a small physical symptom. So do they have, you know, maybe they have a finger that won't straighten, or maybe they have just this twinge in their knee, or maybe they have an ache in their lower back. Find one, isolate one small physical thing, or a movement thing. How many people can actually touch their toes? This is a real, real good way to get people to have, there's something going on here, sort of realization. Ask them to bend down and see how close they can get to touching their toes. Okay? Both of you sort of measure that. Then do a whole load of tapping, even though I can't touch my toes, or even though it hurts when I get so far, whatever. Then ask them to have another go. And it's almost guaranteed they will get another 6 inches or even a foot closer to touching their toes. So that's a similar way of doing it if you suspect that asking for a memory could come up with difficulties.
I remember Gary Crape in his videos talking about breathing restrictions.
That's another good way to introduce it. Yeah, that's...
Never worked for me.
Sorry?
Never worked for me.
Well, maybe you're pretty relaxed anyway.
Oh, I've got a very stuffy nose.
Okay. What you want to do is take a real big breath, and it's like not so much your stuffy nose, the feeling of the capacity of your lungs.
Okay.
Where, so you take a great big breath, and then another great big breath, and just don't hold it, just sort of let it out, and just become aware of the quality of your breathing. And is there any tightness or restriction in your breathing, in the capacity of your lungs? And then give yourself a number on a scale where naught is deep and easy breathing, no restriction at all, and where 10 is can't breathe. Just give yourself a number. Then do a couple of rounds of tapping, even though there's this tightness in my breathing. And then test it, take a great big breath, notice the quality of your breathing, take another great big breath, and give yourself a number. I find if I do that with a group of about 20 people, then for 18 or possibly all of them, their number will have gone down and they will have much less tightness. For one person, maybe typically in a group of 20, there will be no change. And for one person, it may have got tighter. So all I do then is I just do another round with the whole group. And generally then, for those two who didn't get change, it will have gone down.
Interesting.
And I've been doing that, I do that in every one of my level one training courses, and I've probably taught level one about 100 times. So I've probably, with a lot of demonstration groups, I've probably done that exercise with getting on for 200 groups of people. And that's the typical results. It's a good way to introduce things with a group, because with a group, if you start asking them for memories, somebody is going to pick the day my mother died and get a massive amount of emotion with it. And you don't want that in a group, because the rest of the group will go, oh, no, I'm not doing this. It gets you upset.
Sure.
And if you're on your own, you can't help that one person without taking your attention off the rest of the group. So with groups, until I know they're quite experienced with EFT, I don't go for memories. So I start with the ways I find to introduce it. One is an ache or a pain or some small physical thing. The second is an annoyance, an everyday annoyance. This is a good way to introduce it. If you say to someone, what pushes your buttons? You know, customer service phone lines, people who tailgate, when the garbage men don't put the bin back properly. People have all sorts of, teenagers who leave wet towels on the bathroom floor. People have all these little annoyances. And so you want to tap and get into the details of the little annoyance, and they'll go, oh, well, it's not worth getting, it's just silly, or it doesn't really bother me, or, that they'll get a change. So aches and pains is one way. Common annoyances is another. A third is something that they are anticipating or worrying about, something that's coming up, like an interview or a meeting or something they've been putting off, and to tap for that. So I would start with, particularly with groups, with one of those things before I go for memories. Yeah, because as you've found, and what you're doing is great, and it's really working well with the people you're meeting and working with.
That's what it is.
Sorry?
It's one-on-one.
It's one-on-one, and it's someone you know, but there is a potential with memories for a minefield. So you've got a very well developed intuition, George. If you start along this process of asking this person for the memory and you just get that little uh-oh feeling, then back off and try with something else. But if you don't get that little uh-oh feeling, off you go, and you'll get a great result, and they'll get a great convincer, and we have another person come to EFT.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, I remember one time I fell flat on my face. This woman had some problem. She didn't want to talk about it. So I tried the tapping on it without the explanation. And it didn't work. And I thought about it. Well, duh, George. That means it's a complex issue. She's got at least the two parts to it.
Yeah. What I would, if someone says they don't want to talk about it, I would start with, even though I don't want to talk about this.
Yeah, but see, I'm talking about just a demonstration. See, so if they have, I don't want to talk about it, then it's a complex issue. It's not a simple issue.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to work on that. That's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially with a demonstration, you never want to push someone. Because, a demonstration, you want to find something which is simple and single and okay to work on. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Okay. At last we found the time when we're both awake. No, I think it's close to your bedtime now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Close. Okay. So let me stop the recording here.